Blackstone Audio presents The Wine Dark Sea by Patrick O'Brien. For Richard Simon and Vivian Green. Chapter 1. A purple ocean, vast under the sky and devoid of all visible life apart from two minute ships racing across its immensity. They were as close-hauled to the somewhat irregular northeast trades as ever they could be, with every sail they could safely carry and even more, their bowlines twanging taut. They had been running like this day after day, sometimes so far apart that each saw only the other's topsails above the horizon, sometimes within gunshot. And when this was the case, they fired at one another with their chasers. The foremost ship was the Franklin, an American privateer of 22 guns, 9-pounders, and her pursuer was the Surprise, a 28-gun frigate formerly belonging to the Royal Navy but now acting as a privateer too, manned by privateersmen and volunteers. She was nominally commanded by a half-pay officer named Thomas Pullings, but in fact by her former captain, Jack Aubrey, a man much higher on the post-captain's list than would ordinarily have been found in so small and antiquated a ship. An anomalous craft entirely, for although she purported to be a privateer, her official, though unpublished, status was that of His Majesty's hired vessel, Surprise. She had set out on her voyage with the purpose of carrying her surgeon, Stephen Maturin, to South America, there to enter into contact with those leading inhabitants who wished to make Chile and Peru independent of Spain. For Maturin, as well as being a doctor of medicine, was an intelligence agent exceptionally well qualified for this task, being a Catalan on his mother's side and bitterly opposed to Spanish, that is to say, Castilian, oppression of his country. He was indeed opposed to oppression in all its forms, and in his youth he had supported the United Irishmen, his father was a Catholic Irish officer in the Spanish service, in everything but the violence of 1798. But above all, far above all, he abhorred that of Bonaparte, and was perfectly willing to offer his services to the British government to help put an end to it, to offer them gratis pro deo, thus doing away with any hint of the odious name of spy, a vile wretch hired by the ministry to inform upon his friends, a name associated in his Irish childhood with that of Judas, Spy Wednesday coming just before the Passion. His present undertaking, resumed after a long interruption caused by the traitorous passing of information from London to Madrid, gave him the greatest satisfaction, for its success would not only weaken the two oppressors, but it would also cause extreme anger and frustration in a particular department of French intelligence that was trying to bring about the same result, though with the difference that the independent South American governments should feel loving and strategically valuable gratitude towards Paris rather than London. He had had many causes for satisfaction since they left the Polynesian island of Oahu in pursuit of the Franklin. One was that the American had chosen to rely on her remarkable powers of sailing very close to the wind, on a course that was leading them directly towards his destination. Another was that, although her sailing master, an old Pacific hand from Nantucket, handled her with uncommon skill, doing everything in his power to run clear or shake off his pursuer by night, neither his guile nor his seamanship could outmatch Aubrey's. If the Franklin slipped a raft over the side in the darkness, lighting lanterns upon it, dousing her own and changing course, she found the Surprise in her wake when the day broke clear. For Jack Aubrey had the same instinct, the same sense of timing, and a far greater experience of war. Still another cause for satisfaction was that every successive noonday observation showed them slanting rapidly down towards the equator, and some 200 miles or more closer to Peru, a country that Dr. Maturin associated not only with potential independence, but also with the coca plant, a shrub whose dried leaves he, like the Peruvians, was accustomed to chew as a relief from mental or spiritual distress and physical or intellectual weariness, as well as a source of benignity and general well-being. Rats, however, had eaten his store of leaves somewhere south of Capricorn. Coca leaves could not be replaced in New South Wales, where the Surprise had spent some dismal weeks, and he looked forward eagerly to a fresh supply. Ever since he last heard from his wife, letters had caught up with the ship off Norfolk Island, He had felt a deep, indwelling anxiety about her, and the coca leaves might at least dispel the irrational part of it. They sharpened the mind wonderfully, and he welcomed the prospect of that familiar taste, the deadening of the inside of his mouth and pharynx, and the calming of his spirit in what he termed a virtuous ataraxy, a freedom that owed nothing to alcohol, that contemptible refuge, nor even to his old love opium, which might be objected to on physical, and even perhaps on moral grounds. This was scarcely a subject that so discreet, private, and indeed secretive a person as Stephen Maturin was likely to discuss, and although it flashed into his mind as a piece of green seaweed rose momentarily on the bow wave, all he said to his companion was, "It is a great satisfaction to see the ocean a colour so near to that of new wine, of certain kinds of new wine, as it comes gushing from the press." He and Nathaniel Martin, his assistant surgeon, were standing in the frigate's beakhead, a roughly triangular place in front of and below the forecastle, the very foremost part of the ship where the bowsprit reached out, where the seaman's privy was to be found, and where the medicos were least in the way, not only of the hands trimming the sails to capture the greatest possible thrust from the wind, but, and above all, of the gunners serving the two bow chasers on the forecastle, guns that pointed almost directly forward. The gun crews in question were commanded by Captain Aubrey himself, who pointed and fired the windward chaser, a long brass 9-pounder called Beelzebub, and by Captain Pullings, who did the same for the leeward gun. They both had much the same style of firing, which was not surprising, since Captain Pullings had been one of Jack's midshipmen in his first command, a great while ago in the Mediterranean, and had learnt all his practical gunnery from him. They were now very carefully aiming their pieces at the Franklin's topsail yards with the intent of cutting halyards, backstays, and the whole nexus of cordage at the level of the mainyard, and even with luck of wounding the mainyard itself, in any case of delaying her progress without damage to her hull. There was no point in battering the hull of a prize, and a prize the Franklin seemed fated to be in the long run, perhaps even today, since the surprise was perceptibly gaining. The range was now 1,000 yards, or even a little less, and both Jack and Pullings waited for just before the height of the roll to send their shot racing over the broad stretch of water. "The captain does not like it, however," observed Maturin, referring to the wine-dark sea. "He says it is not natural. He admits the colour, which we have all seen in the Mediterranean on occasion. He admits the swell, which, though unusually broad, is not rare, but the colour and the swell together..." The crash and rumble of the captain's gun, followed with scarcely a pause by Pullings, cut him short. Smoke and smouldering scraps of wad whistled about their heads, yet even before they swept away to leeward, Stephen had his spyglass to his eye. He could not catch the flight of the ball, but in 3 heartbeats he saw a hole appear low in the Frenchman's topsail, joining a score of others. To his astonishment, he also saw a jet of water shoot from her lee scuppers, and above him he heard Tom Pullings cry, "They are starting their water, sir!" "What does this signify?" asked Martin quietly. He had not applied to a very valuable source, Dr. Maturin being strictly a land animal, but in this case Stephen could truthfully reply that they were pumping their fresh water over the side to lighten the ship and make it go faster. "Perhaps," he added, "they may also throw their guns and boats overboard. I have seen it done." A savage cheer from all the surprises in the forepart of the ship showed him that he was seeing it again, and having watched the first few splashes, he passed Martin the glass. The boats went overboard, and the guns, but not quite all the guns. As the Franklin's speed increased, her 2 stern chasers fired together, the white smoke streaming away across her wake. "How disagreeable it is to be fired at," said Martin, shrinking into as small a space as possible. And as he spoke, one ball hit the best bower anchor close behind them with an enormous clang. The sharp fragments, together with a second ball, cut away almost all the fore-topgallant mast's support. The mast and its attendant canvas fell quite slowly, spars breaking right and left, and the surprise's bow chasers just had time to reply, both shots striking the Franklin's stern. But before either Jack's or Pullings's crew could reload their guns, they were enveloped in sailcloth, whilst at the same time all hands aft raised the cry, "Man overboard!" And the ship flew up into the wind, all her sails taken aback and clattering like a madhouse. The Franklin fired a single gun, an extraordinary cloud of smoke, an extraordinary report, but it was drowned by Captain Aubrey's roar of, "Clew up! Clew up there!" And emerging from the canvas, "Where away?"
"Larboard quarter, sir," cried several hands. "It's Mr. Reed."
"Carry on, Captain Fullings," said Jack,
whipping off his shirt and diving straight into the sea. He was a powerful swimmer, the only one in the ship, and from time to time he heaved himself high out of the water like a seal to make sure of his direction. Mr. Reed, a midshipman of 14, had never been able to do much more than keep afloat, and since losing an arm in a recent battle he had not bathed at all. Fortunately, the remaining arm was firmly hooked into the bars of a hen-coop that had been thrown to him from the quarter-deck, and though sodden and bruised, he was perfectly in possession of his wits.
"Oh, sir," he cried from 20 yards, "oh, sir, I'm so sorry. Oh, I hope we haven't missed a chase."
"Are you hurt?"
asked Jack.
"Not at all, sir, but I'm so sorry you should have—"
"Then clap on to my hair."
The captain wore it long and clubbed.
"And so get set on my shoulders. Do you hear me there?"
From time to time on the way back to the ship, Reed apologized into Jack's ear or hoped they had not lost the chase. But he was often choked with salt water, for Jack was now swimming against the wind and the set of the sea, and he plunged deep at every stroke. Reed was less coldly received aboard than might have been expected. In the first place, he was much esteemed by all hands, and in the second, it was clear to any seaman that his being rescued had not in fact delayed the pursuit of the prize. Whether Reed had gone overboard or not, the shattered cross-trees had to be replaced, and new spars, sails, and cordage had to be sent aloft before the frigate could resume her course. Those few hands who were not extremely busy with a tangle forward passed him the bite of a rope, hauled him aboard, asked him with real kindness how he did, and handed him over to Sarah and Emily Sweeting, two little black girls from a remote Melanesian island belonging to Dr. Maturin and attached to the sick berth, to be led below and given dry clothes and a cup of tea. And as he went, even Awkward Davies, who had been rescued twice and who often resented sharing the distinction, called out,
"It was me as tossed you the end-cope, sir. I heaved it overboard.
As for the captain, he was already in conference with Mr. Bulkley, the boatswain, and the only congratulations he received were from Pullings, who said,
"Well, and so you've done it again, sir,"
before going on to the for-topmast cheek-blocks. Jack looked for no more, indeed not for as much. He had pulled so many people out of the water in the course of his time at sea that he thought little of it, while those who, like Bondon, his coxswain, Killick, his steward, and several others, had served with him ever since his first command, had seen him do it so often that it seemed natural. Some goddamned lubber fell in, the skipper fished him out, while the privateersmen and smugglers who made up most of the rest of the crew had acquired much of their shipmates' phlegm. In any case, they were all much too preoccupied with getting the barkie into chasing trim again to indulge in abstract considerations, and to objective spectators like Maturin and his assistant, it was a pleasure to see the intense, accurately directed and almost silent energy with which they worked, a highly skilled crew of seamen who knew exactly what to do and who were doing it with wholehearted zeal. The medicos, having crawled from under the for-topmast staysail, had gone below to find Reed perfectly well, being fed with sick berth biscuit by the little girls, and now they were watching the strenuous activity from the quarter-deck, where the ordinary life of the ship was going on in a sparse sort of way. West, the officer of the watch, was at his station, telescope under his arm, helmsman and quartermaster by the wheel.
"Turn the glass and strike the bell,"
cried the quartermaster in a loud official voice. There was no one there, of course, to obey the order, so he turned the glass himself and paced forward towards the belfry to strike the bell. But both gangways were obstructed with spars, cordage, and a crowd of straining bodies, and he had to go down into the waist and pick his way among the carpenter and his crew as they worked, sweating under the sun, now halfway to its height and terrible in the copper-coloured sky. They were shaping not only the new cross-trees, but also the heel of the new t'gallant mast, an intent body of men working to very fine limits in a rolling ship, plying sharp-edged tools and impatient of the slightest interruption. But the quartermaster was a dogged soul. He had served with Nelson in the Agamemnon and the Vanguard. He was not going to be stopped by a parcel of carpenters, and presently four bells rang out their double chime. The quartermaster returned, followed by oaths, and bringing with him the two helmsmen who were to take their trick at the wheel.
"Mr. West," said Stephen, "do you suppose we shall eat our dinner today?"
Mr. West's expression was difficult to read. The loss of his nose, frost-bitten south of the horn, gave what had been a mild, good-humoured, rather stupid face an appearance of malignity, and this was strengthened by a number of sombre reflections more recently acquired.
"Oh, yes," he said absently. "Unless we are in close action, we always shoot the sun and pipe to dinner at noon."
"No, no, I mean our ceremony in the gun-room."
"Oh, of course," said West. "What with Reed going overboard and the chase stopping us dead and tearing away like smoke and oakum just as we were overhauling her, it slipped my mind. Masthead there," he hailed. "What do you see?"
"Precious little, sir,"
the voice came floating down.
"It's a cruel, hazy, orange sorts of haze in the southeast, but sometimes I catch what might be a twinkle of t'gallants."
West shook his head, but went on.
"No, no, Doctor. Never you fret about our dinner. Cook and steward laid it on handsome, and though we may be a little late, I'm sure we shall eat it. There, do you see the cross-trees go aloft? They will be swaying up the mast directly."
"Will they, indeed? Order out of chaos so soon?"
"Certainly they will. Never you fret about your dinner."
"I will not," said Stephen,
who accepted what seamen told him about ships with the same simplicity as that with which they accepted what he told them about their bodies.
"Take this bolus," he would say. "It will rectify the humours amazingly."
And they, holding their noses, for he often used asafoetida, would force the rounded mass down, gasp, and feel better at once. With his mind at ease, therefore, Stephen said to Martin,
"Let us make our forenoon rounds,"
and went below. West, left to his solitude, returned to his own fretting. An inadequate word for his concerns for the future and his anxiety about the present. Captain Aubrey had begun this much-interrupted voyage with his old shipmate Tom Pullings acting as his first lieutenant, and two broken officers, West and Davidge, as second and third. He did not know them as anything but competent seamen, but he was aware that the sentences of their courts-martial had been thought extremely harsh in the service. West was dismissed for duelling, Davidge for signing a dishonest purser's accounts without checking them, and that reinstatement was their chief aim in life. Up until recently, they had been in a fair way to it, but when the Surprise was nearly 1,000 miles out of Sydney Cove, sailing eastwards across the Pacific Ocean, it was found that a senior midshipman named Oakes had stowed a young gentlewoman away in the cable tier, and this had led almost all the gunroom officers except Dr. Maturin to behave extremely badly. Her instant marriage to Oakes had set her free in that she was no longer a transported convict liable to be taken up again, but it did not liberate her from the adulterous wishes, motions, and jealousies of her shipmates. West and Davidge were the worst, and Captain Aubrey, coming late to an understanding of the position, had told them that if they did not put aside the barbarous, open enmity that was spreading discord and inefficiency in the ship, he would turn them ashore. Farewell forever to any hope of reinstatement. Davidge had been killed in the recent action that made the Polynesian island of Oahu at least a nominal part of the British Empire, and Oakes had gone off for Batavia with his Clarissa in a recaptured prize. But so far Captain Aubrey had said nothing. West did not know whether his zeal in the approaches to Oahu and in getting the carronades up through rough country and his modest part in the battle itself had earned him forgiveness, or whether he should be dismissed when the ship reached Peru. An agonizing thought. What he did know, here and in the immediate present, was that a valuable prize in which he would share, even if he were later dismissed, had almost certainly escaped. They would never catch her before nightfall, and in this hazy, moonless darkness she could run 100 miles, never to be seen again.
That was one torment to his spirit. Another was that this morning Captain Aubrey had promoted Granger, a forecastleman in the starboard watch, to fill the vacancy left by Davidge's death, just as he had raised a young fellow called Sam Norton to replace Oakes.
West had to admit that Granger was a capital seaman, a master mariner who had sailed his own brig on the Guinea run until he was taken by two Sally Rovers off Cape Spartel. But he did not like the man at all. He had already known what it was to be shut up in the gunroom with a shipmate he detested, seeing him at every meal, hearing his voice. And now it seemed that he should have to go through the odious experience again, for at least the breadth of the Pacific. Yet more than that, far more, he felt that the gunroom and the quarterdeck, the privileged places in a man of war, were not only sacred in themselves, but that they conferred a kind of sanctity on their rightful inhabitants, a particular being and an identity. He felt this strongly, though he found the notion difficult to express. And now that Davidge was dead, there was nobody with whom he could discuss it. Pullings was a small tenant farmer's son. Adams, though he acted as purser, was only the captain's clerk, and Martin did not seem to think either family or caste of much importance. Dr. Maturin, who lived almost entirely with the captain, being his particular friend, was of illegitimate birth, and the subject could not be raised with him. While even if West had been in high favour with his commander, it would have been quite useless to suggest that if it was necessary to promote foremast jacks, as it was in this case, then they might be made master's mates, herding with the midshipmen, so that the gunroom should be preserved. Useless, because Jack Aubrey belonged to an older navy, in which a collier's mate like James Cook could die a much honoured post-captain, and a foremast hand like William Mitchell might begin his career by being flogged round the fleet and end it as a vice-admiral, rather than to the modern service, in which an officer had not only to pass for lieutenant, but also for gentleman, if he were to advance. Dr. Maturin and his assistant had the usual seamen's diseases to treat, and a few wounds to dress, not from the recent battle, which had been a mere point-blank butchery of an enemy caught in a narrow, rocky defile, but from the wear and tear of dragging guns up and down a jungly mountainside. They also had one interesting case of a sailor who, less sure-footed by land than by sea, had fallen onto the pointed end of a cut bamboo, which let air into the cavity of his thorax, into his pleura, with the strangest effect on one lung. This they discussed at length, in Latin, to the great satisfaction of the sick berth, where heads turned gravely from one speaker to the other, nodding from time to time, while the patient himself looked modestly down, and Padine Coleman, Dr. Maturin's almost monoglot Irish servant and loblolly boy, wore his mass-going, reverential face. They never heard the orders that attended the swaying up of the new t'gallant mast, an anxious business at such a height, and with such a swell. Nor did they hear the cry of, "Launch ho!" as the boatswain's mate at the topmast head banged the fid home through the heel of the t'gallant mast, thus supporting it on the topmast trestle tree. The complex business of securing the long, unhandy pole escaped them too, an exceedingly complex business, for although before the swaying up the shrouds had been placed over the head of the mast, followed by the backstays, the preventer stays, and the very stay itself, they all had to be made fast, bowsed upon, and set up simultaneously with all possible dispatch, so that they exerted an equally balanced force fore and aft, and on either side. The rigging of the t'gallant yard, with all its appurtenances, also passed unnoticed. So did two typical naval illogicalities. For whereas by tradition and good sense only the lightest of the topmen laid out on the lofty yard to loose the sail, this time, once it was loosed, sheeted home and hoisted, the captain, with his acknowledged 16 stone, ran aloft with his glass to sweep what vague horizon could still be distinguished through the growing haze. But the medical men and their patients did make out the cheer as the ship returned to her former course, and they did feel her heel as she gathered way, running with a far more lively motion, while all the mingled sounds of the wind in the rigging and the water streaming along her side took on the urgent note of a ship chasing once more. Almost immediately after the surprise had settled into her accustomed pace, shouldering the strange coloured sea high and wide, the hands were piped to dinner, and in the usual bedlam of cries and banging mess kids that accompanied the ceremony, Stephen returned to the quarterdeck, where the captain was standing at the windward rail, gazing steadily out to the eastward. He felt Stephen's presence and called him over.
"I have never seen anything like it,"
he said, nodding at the sea and the sky.
"It is much thicker now than it was when I went below," said Stephen. "And now an umber light pervades the whole, like a Claude Lorraine run mad."
"We had no noon observation, of course," said Jack. "There was no horizon, and there was no sun to bring down to it either. But what really puzzles me is that every now and then, quite independent of the swell, the sea twitches. A quick pucker like a horse's skin when there are flies about. There, did you see? A little quick triple wave on the rising swell.
I did too. It is extremely curious, said Stephen. Can you assign any cause?
No, said Jack. I've never heard of such a thing.
He reflected for some minutes, and at each lift of the frigate's bows the spray came sweeping aft.
But quite apart from all this, he went on, I finished the draft of my official letter this morning, before we came within gunshot, and I should be uncommonly obliged if you would look through it, strike out errors and anything low, and put in some stylish expressions, before Mr. Adams makes his fair copies.
Sure, I will put in what style there is at my command. But why do you say copies, and why are you in haste? Whitehall is half the world away, or even more for all love.
Because in these waters we may meet with a homeward-bound whaler any day.
Really? Really? Oh, indeed. Very well, I shall come as soon as our dinner is properly disposed of, and I shall write to Diana, too.
Your dinner? Oh, yes, of course, I do hope it goes well. You will be changing very soon, no doubt.
He had no doubt at all, because his steward Killick, who also looked after Dr. Maturin on formal occasions, had made his appearance, standing at what he considered a respectful distance, and fixing them with his shrewish, disapproving eye. He had been with them for many years in all climates, and although he was neither very clever nor at all agreeable, he had, by mere conviction of righteousness, acquired an ascendancy of which both were ashamed. Killick coughed.
"And if you should see Mr. West," added Jack, "pray tell him I should like to see him for a couple of minutes. I do hope your dinner goes well,"
he called after Stephen's back. The dinner in question was intended to welcome Granger, now Mr. Granger, to the gunroom. Stephen, too, hoped that it would go well, and although he ordinarily ate his meals with Jack Aubrey in the cabin, he meant to take his place in the gunroom for this occasion. Since, in principle, the surgeon was a gunroom officer, his absence might be taken as a slight. Granger, a reserved, withdrawn man, was much respected aboard, for although he had not belonged to the surprise during her heroic days as a privateer, when she recaptured a Spaniard deep laden with quicksilver, took an American commerce raider and cut out the Diane from the harbour of St. Martin's, he was well known to at least half the crew. He had joined at the beginning of this voyage, very highly recommended by his fellow townsmen of Shelmiston, a port that had provided the surprise with scores of prime seamen, a curious little West Country place, much given to smuggling, privateering, and chapel-going. There were almost as many chapels as there were public houses, and Granger was an elder of the congregation of Traskites, who met on Saturdays in a severe, sad-coloured building behind the rope walk. Although the Traskites' views were controversial, he and the younger men who came aboard with him were perfectly at home in the surprise, which was an arc of descent, containing Brownists, Sethians, Arminians, Muggletonians, and several others, generally united in a seaman-like tolerance when afloat, and always in a determined hatred of tithes when ashore. Stephen was well acquainted with him as a shipmate and above all as a patient, two calentures, a broken clavicle, and he valued his many qualities. But he knew very well how such a man, dignified and assured in his own circle, could suffer when he was removed from it. Pullings would be kindness itself. So would Adams. But kindness alone was not necessarily enough with so vulnerable a man as Granger. Martin would certainly mean well, but he had always been more sensitive to the feelings of birds than to those of men, and prosperity seemed to have made him rather selfish. Although he was sailing as Stephen's assistant, he was in fact a clergyman, and Jack had recently given him a couple of livings in his gift, with a promise of a valuable third when it should fall in. Martin had all the particulars of these parishes, and he discussed them over and over again, considering the possibility of different modes of gathering tithes or their equivalent, and improvement of the glebes. But worse than the dullness of this conversation was a self-complacency that Stephen had never known in the penniless Martin of some years ago, who was incapable of being a bore. West he was not sure of. Here again there had been change. The moody, snappish, nail-biting West of their present longitude was quite unlike the cheerful young man who had so kindly and patiently rowed him about Botany Bay looking for seaweed. "Oh, Mr. West," he said, opening the gunroom door. "Before I forget it, the captain would like to see you for a minute or two. I believe he is in the cabin."
"Jesus," cried West,
looking shocked, then recollecting himself. "Thank you, Doctor." He ran into his cabin, put on his best coat, and hurried up the ladder.
"Come in,"
called Jack. "I understand you wish to see me, sir."
"Oh, yes, Mr. West, but I shall not keep you a minute. Push those files aside and sit on the locker. I'd meant to speak to you before, but I've been so taken up with paperwork that I've left it day after day. It is just to tell you that I was thoroughly satisfied with your conduct through our time at Moahu, particularly your exertion in getting the carronades up that infernal mountain, most officer-like. I have mentioned it in my official letter, and I believe that if only you had contrived to be wounded, you might have been fairly confident of reinstatement. Perhaps you will do better next time."
"Oh, I shall do my very best, sir," cried West. "Arms, legs, anything. And may I say how infinitely I'm obliged to you for mentioning me, sir?" "Mr. Granger, welcome to the gunroom," said Tom Pullings, splendid in his uniform. "Here is your place, next to Mr. West. But first, messmates, let us drink to Mr. Granger's health."
"Good health! Hear him! Huzzay! And welcome!"
cried the other four, emptying their glasses.
"My dear love to you all, gentlemen," said Granger, sitting down in a good blue coat borrowed from his cousin, the carpenter, looking pale under his tan, grim and dangerous.
But grimness could not withstand Pullings and Stephen's goodwill, far less West's surprising flow of spirits. His happiness broke out in an extraordinary volubility, a thoroughly amiable volubility, and he rose high above his ordinary powers of anecdote and comic rhyme. And when he was not proposing riddles, he laughed. There was no doubt that Granger was pleased with his reception. He ate well, he smiled, he even laughed once or twice. But all the time Maturin saw his quick, nervous eyes flitting from plate to plate, seeing just how the gunroom ate its dinner, managed its bread and drank its wine. Yet by pudding time and toasts, the anxiety was gone. Granger joined in the song, "Farewell and adieu to your fine Spanish ladies," and even proposed one of his own. "As I walked out one midsummer's morning, for to view the fields and the flowers so gay."
"From what I could make out here on deck," said Jack, when Stephen joined him for coffee, "your dinner seemed quite a cheerful affair."
"It went off as well as ever I had hoped," said Stephen. "Mr. West was in a fine flow of spirits. Jokes, riddles, conundrums, imitations of famous commanders, songs. I did not know he possessed such social gifts."
"I am heartily glad of it," said Jack. "But, Stephen, you look a little worn."
"I am a little worn, all the more so for having first stepped on deck for a breath of air. The appearance of the ocean appalled me. I asked Bondon what he thought. Was it often like this? He only shook his head and wished we might all be here come Sunday. Jack, what do you think? Have you considered it?"
"I considered it most of the time your Nebuchadnezzar's feast was going on, and I can't remember ever having seen or read of anything like it, nor can I tell what it means. When you have glanced over my draft, perhaps we might go on deck again and see whether we can make it out."
Jack always sat uneasy while his official letters were read. He always broke the current of the reader's thoughts by saying,
"The piece about the carronade slides ain't very elegantly put, I'm afraid. This is just a draft, you understand, not polished at all. Anything that ain't grammar, or that you don't quite like, pray dash it out. I never was much of a hand with a pen."
But after all these years, Stephen took no more notice of it than the thin, drifting Irish rain.
With Jack's voice in the background, the roll and pitch of the ship and the crash of the sea on her weather bow never affecting his concentration, he read a succinct narrative cast in the wooden service style.
The Surprise, proceeding eastwards in accordance with their lordship's instructions, had been overtaken in latitude 28 degrees 31 minutes south, longitude 168 degrees 1 minute east, by a cutter from Sydney, with official information that the inhabitants of the island of Moahu were at war with one another, and that the British seamen were being ill-used and their ships detained. Captain Aubrey was to deal with the situation, backing whichever side seemed more likely to acknowledge British sovereignty. He had therefore changed course for Moahu without loss of time, pausing only at Anamooka for water and provisions. Here he found the whaler Daisy, recently from Moahu, whose master, Mr. Wainwright, informed him that the war between the chief of the northern part of Moahu and the queen of the south was complicated by the presence of a number of French mercenaries on the chief's side,
and of a privateer under American colours, the Franklin, commanded by another Frenchman allied to the chief, a Monsieur Dutour. Acting upon this information, Captain Aubrey therefore proceeded with the utmost dispatch to Pabe, the northern port of Oahu, in the hope of finding the Franklin at anchor. She was not there, so having released the detained British ship, the True Love, together with her surviving crew, and having destroyed the French garrison with the loss of one officer killed and two seamen wounded, he hastened to the southern harbour, which was about to be attacked from the mountains by the northern chief, and probably from the sea by the privateer. The surprise arrived in time. Her people had the happiness of defeating the northern land forces without loss before the arrival of the privateer, and Captain Aubrey received the assurance of the Queen's willingness to be a faithful ally to His Majesty. Here followed a more detailed account of the two actions, and the letter returned to the appearance of the Franklin next morning, her inferior force, her flight, and Captain Aubrey's hope that in spite of her excellent sailing qualities, she might soon be captured.
"It seems to me a perfectly straightforward seamanlike account," said Stephen, closing the folder. "Admirably calculated for Whitehall, apart from a few quibbles I have pencilled in the margin. And I see why West was so happy."
"Yes, I thought it due to him. And perhaps I laid it on a little heavy, because I was so sorry about Davidge. Thank you, Stephen. Shall we go on deck?"
It was indeed a lurid and portentous sight, the sky quite hidden, and the diffused glow, now more orange than umber, showed an irregularly turbulent sea, flecked as far as the eye could see, which was not much above 3 miles, with broken water that should have been white, and that in fact had taken on an unpleasant acid greenish tinge, most evident in the frigate's leeward bow wave, an irregular bow wave too, for now, although the swell was still very much present, rolling strongly from the northeast, the series of crests was interrupted by innumerable cross-seas. They stood in silence, and all along the gangway and on the forecastle there were little groups of seamen gazing in the same attentive way, with a few low, murmured words.
"It is not unlike the typhoon that so nearly did for us when we were running for the Marquesas, south of the line," observed Jack. "But there are essential differences. The glass is perfectly steady, for one thing. Yet even so, I believe I shall strike t'gallant masts."
Raising his voice, he called for the boatswain and gave the order. It was at once followed by the wailing of pipes and entirely superfluous cries of,
"All hands to strike t'gallant masts! All hands! All hands! Do you hear me there?"
Without a word of complaint or a wry look, for they were much of the captain's mind, the patient surprises laid aloft to undo all they had done with such pains in the forenoon watch. They cast off all that had to be cast off. They clapped on to the mast rope and by main force raised the foretogallant so that the fid could be drawn out again and the whole lowered down. And this they did to the others in succession, as well as running in the jib boom, making all fast and double griping the boats.
"A pretty half-wit I may look if the poor souls have to sway them up again tomorrow," said Jack in a low voice. "But when I was very young, I had such a lesson about not getting your upper masts down on deck in plenty of time. Such a lesson. Now we are on deck, I could tell you about it, pointing out the various ropes and spars."
"That would give me the utmost pleasure," said Stephen.
"It was when I was coming back from the Cape in the Minerva, a very wet ship, Captain Sewell's. Once we were north of the line, we had truly miserable weather, a whole series of gales from the westward. But the day after Christmas, the wind grew quite moderate, and we not only let a reef out of the main topsail, but also sent up the t'gallant mast and yard. Yet during the night it freshened once more, and we close-reefed the topsails again, got the t'gallant yard down on deck, and shaped the mast."
"Before this it was amorphous, I collect? Shapeless?"
"What a fellow you are, Stephen! Shaping a mast means getting it ready to be struck. But, however, while this was in train, with the people tailing on to the mast rope, the one that raises it a little, do you see, so that it can have a clear run down, the ship took a most prodigious lee lurch, flinging all hands, still fast to their rope, into the scuppers. And since they hung on like good'uns, this meant that they raised the heel of the mast right up above the cross-trees, so that although the fid was out, it could not be lowered down. Do you follow me, Stephen? With my fid and heel and cross-trees?"
"Perfectly, my dear. A most uncomfortable position, sure."
"So it was, upon my word.
and before we could do anything about it, the topmast springstays parted, then the topmast stay itself, and the mast went a few feet above the cap, and, falling upon the lee topsail yardarm, carried that away too, and all this mare's nest came down on the mainyard, parting the lee lift. That is the lee lift, you see. Then the weather quarter of the mainyard, hitting the top, shattered the weather side of the cross-trees, so that as far as the sails were concerned, the mainmast was useless. At that very moment, the ship broached to, huge green seas coming aft. We survived, but ever since then I have been, perhaps, over-cautious, though this afternoon I had meant to reduce sail in any event.
You do not fear losing the prize?
Certainly I fear losing the prize. I should never say anything so unlucky as, no, she is ours. I may lose her, of course, but you saw her start her water over the side, did you not?
Sure, I saw the water and the guns, and I saw how she drew away, free of all that weight. I spent a few moments liberating poor Mr. Martin from behind the seat of ease, where the wreckage had imprisoned him, and he so squeamish about excrement, the creature, and when I looked up again she was much smaller, flying with a supernatural velocity.
Yes, she holds a good wind, but she cannot cross the Pacific with what very little water she may have left. They pumped desperate hard, and I saw ton after ton shoot into the sea. So she must double back to Oahu. The Sandwich Islands are much too far. I think he will put before the wind at about 10 o'clock, meaning to slip past us with all lights doused during the graveyard watch. No moon, you know, and be well to the west of us by dawn while we are still cracking on like mad lunatics the eastward. My plan is to lie to in a little while, keeping a very sharp lookout. And if I do not mistake, she will be in sight a little to the south at break of day, with a wind on her quarter and all possible sail abroad. I should add, he went on after a pause in which Stephen appeared to be considering, that taking into account her leeway, which I have been measuring ever since the chase began, I mean first to take the ship quite a long way south.
The very same thought was in my mind, said Stephen, though I did not presume to utter it. But tell me, before you lie in, do you not think it might calm our spirits if we were to contemplate, let us say, Corelli, rather than this apocalyptic sea? We have scarcely played a note since before Oahu. I never thought to dislike the setting sun, but this one adds an even more sinister tinge to everything in sight, unpleasant though it was before. Besides, those tawny clouds flying in every direction, and these irregular waves, these boils of water, fill me with melancholy thoughts.
I should like it of all things, said Jack. I do not intend to beat to quarters this evening. The people have had quite enough for one day, so we can make an early start.
A fairly early start, for the irregular waves that had disturbed Stephen Maturin's sense of order in nature now pitched him headlong down the companion ladder, where Mr. Granger, standing at its foot, received him as phlegmatically as he would have received a half-sack of dried peas, set him on his feet and told him that he should always keep one hand for himself and the other for the ship. But the doctor had flown down sideways, an ineffectual snatch at the rail having turned him about his vertical axis, so that Granger caught him with one iron hand on his spine and the other on his upper belly, winding him to such an extent that he could scarcely gasp out a word of thanks. Then, when he had at last recovered his breath and the power of speech, it was found that his chair had to be made fast to two ring bolts to allow him to hold his cello with anything like ease or even safety. He had a Geronimo Amati at home, just as Aubrey had a treasured Guarnieri, but they travelled with rough old things that could put up with extremes of temperature and humidity. The rough old things always started the evening horribly flat, but in time the players tuned them to their own satisfaction, and exchanging a nod, they dashed away into a duet which they knew very well indeed, having played it together these 10 years and more, but in which they always found something fresh, some half-forgotten turn of phrase, or of particular felicity. They also added new pieces of their own, small improvisations or repetitions, each player in turn. They might have pleased Corelli's ghost, as showing what power his music still possessed for a later generation. They certainly did not please Preserved Killick, the captain's steward.
"Yowl, yowl, yowl!" he said to his mate on hearing the familiar sounds. "They are at it again. I have a mind to put rat's bane in their toasted cheese."
"We cannot go on much longer," said Grimble. "The cross sea is getting up something cruel."
It was true.
The ship was cutting such extraordinary capers that even Jack, a merman, if ever there was one, had to sit down, wedging himself firmly on a broad locker. And at the setting of the watch, after their traditional toasted cheese had been eaten, he went on deck to take in the courses and lie to under a close-reefed main topsail. He had, at least by dead reckoning, reached something like the point he had been steering for. The inevitable leeway should do the rest by dawn, and he hoped that now the ship's motion would be eased.
"Is it very disagreeable upstairs?" asked Stephen when he returned. "I hear thunderous rain on the skylight."
"It is not so much very disagreeable as very strange," said Jack. "As black as can be, of course, never the smell of a star, and wet. And there are strong cross seas apparently flowing in three directions at once, which is contrary to reason. Lightning above the cloud, too, showing deep red. Yet there is something else I can hardly put a name to."
He held the lamp close to the barometer, shook his head, and going back to his seat on the locker, he said that the motion was certainly easier. Perhaps they might go back to the Andante.
"With all my heart," said Stephen, "if I might have a rope round my middle to hold me to the chair."
"Of course you may," said Jack. "Killick! Killick there! Lash the doctor into his seat, and let us have another decanter of port."
The Andante wound its slow length along with a curious, gasping, unpredictable rhythm, and when they had brought it to its hesitant end, each looking at the other with reproach and disapproval at each false note, Jack said,
"Let us drink to Zephyrus, the son of Millpond."
He was in the act of pouring a glass when the ship pitched with such extraordinary violence, pitched as though she had fallen into a hole, that he very nearly fell, and the glass left the wine in the air, a coherent body for a single moment.
"This will never do," he said,
and then,
"What in hell was that crash?"
He stood listening for a moment, and then, in reply to a knock on the door, he called,
"Come in!"
"Mr. West's duty, sir," said Norton, the newly appointed midshipman, dripping on the checkered deck cloth, "and there is firing on the larboard bow."
"Thank you, Mr. Norton," said Jack. "I shall come at once."
He quickly stowed his fiddle on the locker and ran on deck. While he was still on the ladder, there was another heavy crash. Then, as he reached the quarterdeck and the pouring rain, several more far forward.
"There, sir,"
said West, pointing to a jetting glow, blurred crimson through the milk-warm rain.
"It comes and goes. I believe we are under mortar fire."
"Beat to quarters,"
called Jack, and the boatswain's mate wound his call.
"Mr. West! Mr. West, there! Do you hear me?"
He raised his voice immensely, calling for a lantern. It showed West, flat on his face, pouring blood.
"Fore topsail,"
cried Jack, putting the ship before the wind, and as she gathered way he told two of the afterguard to carry West below.
"Fore staysail and jib!"
The ship came to life, to battle stations, with a speed and regularity that would have given him deep satisfaction if he had had a second to feel it. Stephen was already in the sick berth, with a sleepy Martin and a half-dressed Padine, when West was brought down, followed by half a dozen foremast hands, two of them walking cases.
"A severe depressed fracture on either side of the coronal suture," said Stephen, having examined West under a powerful lantern, "and of course this apparently meaningless laceration. Deep coma. Padine, Davies, lift him as gently as ever you can to the mattress on the floor back there. Lay him face down with a little small pad under his forehead, the way he can breathe. Next."
The next man, with a compound fracture of his left arm and a series of gashes down his side, required close, prolonged attention, sewing, snipping, binding up. He was a man of exceptional fortitude, even for a foremast jack, and between involuntary gasps, he told them that he had been the larboard midship lookout when he saw this sudden spurt of red to windward and a glow under the cloud, and he was hailing the quarterdeck when he heard something like stones or even grapeshot hitting the topsail, and then there was a great crash and he was down. He lay on the gangway staring through the scuppers, with the rain soaking him through and through, before he understood what had happened. And he saw that red spurt show twice, not like a gun, but more lasting and crimson, perhaps a battery, a ragged salvo. Then a cross sea and a lee lurch tossed him into the waist until old Place and Bondon fished him out. The groaning from a man against the side grew almost to a scream.
"Oh, oh, oh, forgive me, mates, I can't bear it! Oh, 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 oh!"
"Mr. Martin, pray see what you can do," said Stephen. "Sarah, my dear, give me the silk thread needle."
As she passed it, Sarah said in his ear, "Emily is frightened." Stephen nodded, holding the needle between his lips. He was not exactly frightened himself, but he did dread misplacing an instrument or probe. Even down here, the ship was moving with a force he had never known. The lantern swung madly, with no sort of rhythm now, and he could scarcely keep his footing. "This cannot go on," he murmured. But it did go on, and as he and Martin worked far into the night, that part of his mind which was not taken up with probing, sawing, splinting, sewing, and bandaging, heard and partly recorded what was going on around him. The talk between the hands treated or waiting for treatment, the news brought by fresh cases, the seaman's interpretation of the various sounds and cries on deck.
"There's the foretopmast gone."
A long discussion of bomb vessels and the huge mortars they carried. Agreement. Contradiction.
"Oh, for my coca leaves," thought Stephen, who so very urgently needed a clear, sharp mind untouched by sleep and a steady hand.
The maintop was broken, injured or destroyed, but the half-heard voices said they should have had to get the topmast down on deck anyhow, with such a sea running and the poor barky almost arsy-versy every minute. Poor sods on deck. It was worse than the tide race off Sumbra Head.
"This was the day Judas Iscariot was born," said an Orkneyman.
"Mr. Martin, the saw, if you please. Hold back the flap and be ready with a tourniquet. Padine, let him not move at all."
And bending over the patient,
"This will hurt for the moment, but it will not last. Hold steady."
The amputation gave place to another example of these puzzling, lacerated wounds, and Reed came below, followed by Killick with a covered mug of coffee.
"Captain's compliments, sir," said Reed, "and he thinks the worst may be over. Stars in the south-southwest and the swell not quite so pronounced."
"Many thanks, Mr. Reed," said Stephen,
"and God bless you, Killick." He swallowed half the mug, passing Martin the rest.
"Tell me, have we been severely pierced? I hear the pumps have been set a-going, and there is a power of water underfoot."
"Oh, no, sir. The masts and the maintop have suffered, but the water is only the ship working, hauling under the chains, so her seams open a little. May I ask how Mr. West comes along, and Wilcox and Veal of my division?"
"Mr. West is still unconscious. I believe I must open his skull tomorrow. We took Wilcox's fingers off just now. He never said a word, and I think he will do well. Veal I have set back till dawn. An eye is a delicate matter, and we must have daylight."
"Well, sir, that will not be long now. Canopus is dipping, and it should be dawn quite soon."